You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend. And our guest today is Rabbi Stephen Leon, and we're going to talk about a variety of things, about President Trump signing the act to recognize Jerusalem as the official capital of Israel. And we're going to talk also about Rabbi Leon's new book and also a new CD. And we're going to talk a little bit about Robin Helsner, who's coming to Congregation B'nai Zion on Tuesday. Rabbi, thank you so much for being with us here today.
My pleasure to be here.
Now, the Jerusalem Act of 1995 recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The act was to set aside funds for the move of the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Israel has declared the capital is Jerusalem, but it's not internationally recognized. The act also allowed the president to invoke a six-month waiver, and it was repeatedly signed by Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. However, on December 6th of last year, President Trump officially recognized Jerusalem as capital and ordered the State Department to begin planning for that relocation. However, he also signed the waiver, again, delaying the move for at least 6 months. And of course, people who have been mentioned in the media interviewed say that move could take at least a couple of years. So with that brief history lesson, Rabbi, well, first of all, when you and I were at a Paul Wilbur concert last year, and one of the things I remember when you spoke, you talked about when you went to Jerusalem, I think it was for your honeymoon or shortly after, and you talked a little bit about the things that were there. And then, of course, you went back later and changed and talked about how everything has changed so much.
Well, what I talked about was the first time I went to Israel was in 1962. It was a gap year after I graduated high school. And, of course, as a teenager, and I came from a religious home, was raised by my parents, and my father was a cantor in Bridgeport, Connecticut. So when I went to Israel, one of the first things I wanted to do was go to the Western Wall to pray. And I did not realize until I was actually there that the Western Wall was off limits for the Jewish people. It was under the control of Jordan, and from 1948 through the time I was there in 62 and up until 1967, parts of Jerusalem, the old city, was under Jordanian control. And even though I had been told that the United Nations had made an agreement that people of different religions could visit their respective holy places, I soon learned that that was not true. So it was, I had mixed feelings, you know. I was kind of disappointed and frustrated. Could go to the new city of Jerusalem, which was under Israeli control, but not to the old city. And then in 1968, 6 years later, my honeymoon, my wife and I went to Israel for our honeymoon. And the first thing I wanted to do was go to the Western Wall again. And this time, this was after the Six-Day War in June of 1967, when Israel had reunified the old and the new cities of Jerusalem. And then we learned why. Why was the Western Wall off limits? And one of the things that we were told was prior to the Israelis capturing the city, recapturing it, was the fact that the Western Wall had been used as a latrine for King Hussein's horses, that every single synagogue in the old city had been razed to the ground by the Jordanians, that Jewish cemeteries had been overturned and desecrated, and hotels were built upon them. And when you see that, and you understand that, and you're told that, you say that Jerusalem, the holiest city of the Jewish people, must be protected by the people that care most about it, and that is the Jewish people, and that the Israeli Defense Force has to protect the city of Jerusalem, because it's not just a political issue. That's secondary, as far as I'm concerned. It's a religious feeling. Jerusalem, in Hebrew, Yerushalayim, means the city of peace, and that's what it should be. and it should be a city of peace for Christians and Muslims and Jews. We all have holy places there. But I'm saying that the religious places of the Jewish people in the Old City were not accessible to them until 1967.
So with this move that the president announced in December of 2017, as a religious leader, tell us as far as what does this mean for Jews in the United States, Jews here in El Paso, Jews across the world?
What it means, I feel, is that we now can proudly and in a way humbly, proudly from the point of view that this has finally happened, and humbly because Jerusalem is the religious center of Jewish spirituality. When King David galvanized the city of Jerusalem, made it its capital, and started the construction of the first holy temple completed by King Solomon, this was a moment for the Jewish people that really had changed our history, because now we could recognize this city, which has such a rich history of religious spirituality for us, that it's hard to actually even articulate it in words. The political aspect of what the President of the United States did, I think, makes a great deal of sense. To me, from that perspective, you know, the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, has always been in Jerusalem. It has been recognized by the people of Israel since the establishment of the State of Israel. And as I said, going back to King David. So when a significant country, the most significant country in the world, the United States, recognizes Jerusalem, just like in 1948, when Harry Truman, the president, then recognized before the United Nations the establishment of the Jewish state there in the Middle East, that really solidifies the bonds between the United States and Israel and the Jewish people. But in this case, even more so, because other presidents have made that commitment and never followed through on it. So now we can say that the United States and Israel recognize it. Just imagine if you're, I was born in Brooklyn, New York. So what if the people of Brooklyn decided that the capital of the United States shouldn't be Washington, D.C.? Brooklyn's a very nice city. Why can't it be Brooklyn, New York? To me, that's the similarity. A country has the right and it has the obligation to its citizens to establish the city that is going to be revered and known as the capital of that particular country. And that's what the people of Israel did, and now we're in partnership with the United States on that issue, and it's very, very satisfying. Whatever your political position is, it was time. It was more than time, and thank God that now it's happening. So it means an awful lot.
And as far as that decision, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, that Jerusalem Act of 1995 made that designation, but it was invoked various times by the presidents to delay it 6 months, and it just kept being delayed. When President Trump made this announcement, it was welcome, as you mentioned, by Israel and Jews around the world. However, it also raised a lot of eyebrows and anger amongst other people.
Correct, especially among the Palestinians and other Arab nations, because of the fact that there is this desire to have a two-state solution to Israel, which is still has been on the table now for many, many years, even from the time of the Six-Day War. So the fact that Jerusalem was reunited in 67, so that's 50 years ago, a little over 50 years ago, during that war, means, and that was a war that in which Arab nations, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, I believe, had made a desire they were going to push Israel into the sea. That's what their goal was. They'd asked the United Nations peacekeeping forces to leave. So the fact that that miraculous war, which so many nations all over the world recognized the significance of the Defense Forces of Israel means that now this decision solidifies that. Because as I said, to me, whatever we can do to make peace is a reality. But to delay establishing Jerusalem as the capital because some people are upset with that decision is irrelevant. Jerusalem was established by that country to be. It doesn't say that other people can't live there. It doesn't mean that other people can't recognize Jerusalem as the capital. It doesn't really mean anything as far as why people should be so angry. And of course, as soon as it happened, certain nations made declarations of condemning Israel. There were threats that there would be all kinds of violence, etc. Wouldn't it have been better if said, you know what, let's discuss this among ourselves. Let's sit down and talk about it. This is going to be a reality. It's going to happen. The Jewish state of Israel is always going to be there. And there will be those nations that would prefer it not be there. And, you know, we're all aware of the various wars that have taken place from the War of Independence in 1948, when seven Arab nations attacked Israel, when the day the United Nations declares Israel a state. So the fact that Jerusalem is declared the capital, thank God there wasn't a war over it. Just some rallies, some revolts, some activities, some violence. But they're not going to destroy the state of Israel, and they're not going to destroy Jerusalem. It's God's eternal promise, and it's going to continue to be.
So as a religious leader here in El Paso and across the nation, you've been all over the world as well. What happens next?
What happens next is that once again, we reach out to our neighbors in the Middle East and say, let's sit down and talk. Other than that, I can't tell you what will happen until, Golda Meir, I just saw the other day there was a program which showed Anwar Sadat coming to Jerusalem to make peace. And unfortunately, shortly thereafter, he was assassinated by his own people. That gesture of courage on his part was miraculous. And I remember what Golda Meir said to him. And she said, President Sadat, I can forgive you that over the years your soldiers killed our children, but I can never forgive you for the fact that you made our soldiers kill your children. When we will come to a point where both sides will love their children more than what they consider to be their enemies, that's when there will be peace. The children will get along. The leaders are the problem. And there's such a stubbornness and a point of view of terrorism and violence against Israel that we have to remain strong and vigilant. But the peace opportunity will always be there. It was there in 1967, and it is there today.
There has been, as you've mentioned before, and people who read history know, has always been persecution of the Jewish people. And some of those people are people who had to hide because of their religion and were forced to change their religion. And you have written a book about Sephardic Jews, and you also have the Anusim Center, which helps people out as far as finding out more about their roots and things like that. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But first of all, let's talk a little bit about your book and how did that come about?
So when I came, my book really came as a process of experiences that I have had here in this wonderful city of El Paso from the time I moved here in 1986. I'm a Jewish kid from Brooklyn, New York, a very Jewish area, raised in Bridgeport, Connecticut by parents. As I mentioned, my father was a cantor of a synagogue, raised in a religious home. I had a congregation in Elmwood Park, New Jersey for 15 years, from 1971 to 1986. And in all of those years, from my birth in Brooklyn to my coming to El Paso in 86 from New Jersey, I had never, ever met anyone that they called at that time Marranos, who were the descendants of those Jews who were forced to convert during the Spanish Inquisition and who now recognize their Jewish roots. I never met anyone with that background until I came here. And the first week I was here in August of 86, I will never forget it, and I wrote about it in my book, I met the first gentleman. I've told the story many times, but I'll make it very brief. A gentleman from Juarez calls me up and tells me that he's a religious Catholic, and could he come and see me? And I said, of course. And basically his story was, and he was in his 40s, but when he was 3 or 4 years old until 2 weeks ago when his grandmother died, his grandmother had taken him into a dark room on Friday night, every Friday night, lit 2 candles, said a prayer in a language he didn't understand, and then the family had this huge dinner. And he said that he was trying to get the women in his family to redo that or reintroduce that tradition after his grandmother died, and no one would do it. And he wouldn't let go of it. He thought it was disrespectful. He did not know until he came to me that it was a Jewish custom. And so when he came to me after his priest told him, you should see a rabbi, he said, Rabbi, why am I here? What do you have to do with my grandmother? And it didn't dawn on me at that moment, but I said, well, you know what your grandmother did was a Jewish custom. So he said, why would she be doing that? And I said, did you ever hear of the Inquisition? And that was the beginning. That was the beginning. And my book is really the stories that started with that story that have come to me in the last 3 decades that I've been here of people who live in El Paso, who live in Juarez, who live in communities in New Mexico, and other places in Texas and Arizona, who have learned about their Jewish roots, some of whom have actually come back to Judaism, some of whom have just been curious about it. They are very content with their Christian practices, and I bless them for whatever road they choose. But I think it's important that this chapter in world history be taught and be understood, especially here in the Southwest, where there are so many people that have these roots. You know, I was at a conference in San Francisco a number of years ago, and one of the discussions was all about Jewish survival. And it said the speaker was saying that if there had never been a Holocaust, if the 6 million Jews had not been executed, 1.5 million of whom were children, that there would be, instead of less than 14 million Jews in the world, there would be 40 million Jews in the world. And I said to him, what would happen if there was never a Spanish Inquisition? And after a month, he came back to me. And other sociologists and experts and people who are experts on genetics have said to me, have said publicly, that there would be 100 million. In fact, that there are today 100 million people in the world who have Jewish roots, who are practicing Catholicism or Christianity, and they have Jewish roots, some of whom know about it, some of whom don't, because during the difference between the Holocaust and the Inquisition is that most of the people during the Inquisition were not executed. A good number were burnt alive at the stake, but the majority were forcibly converted through the threat of torture devices, expulsion, et cetera, et cetera. And so most of them survived, but many of them became Catholic. Now some of them want to explore their Jewish roots and return. But there are 100 million in the world. I mean, that's an incredible. Imagine if a small percentage did come back to Judaism. It would change the world.
The book itself explains what you mentioned, but you also have the Anusim Center and Tell us a little bit about the center and how it helps people to recognize what you just said.
So besides the book, one of my other dreams was to establish a place with some similarity to what would be like a Holocaust museum, but the difference would be that not only would it teach people about the Spanish Inquisition, but it would also teach people that they have opportunities to explore their Jewish roots through connecting them with a DNA center where they could actually be able to see their Jewish genetic connection. It would also be a place where they could study. It would be a place where they could do research. And it would be a place where we would bring to the community through music, through art, through books, through programming, through guest speakers, an opportunity to learn through these experiences, maybe through a musical concert or maybe through a new book about the subject or in art, some artwork that has been done that recognizes the beauty of the Sephardic Jewish community. All of those are available for people to come and learn about at this Anusim Center. And by the way, just to so that people understand the term Anusim, originally in the discussion I mentioned Marano, which is a negative term because it implies pig, that a person that was Jewish, it's a derogatory term. It's similar when the Nazis called Jews swine. So the politically correct English term today is crypto-Jew, which means a secret Jew. And the word Anusim really has a different nuance because in Hebrew, an Anus is someone who was raped. In other words, someone who was forcibly, was forced to do something horrible against his or her will. And so the person who the B'nai Anusim are the children of the Anusim. Their ancestors were forced to convert, and now the next generation, like you have second and third generation of Holocaust survivors, you now have many more, 30, 40 generations of the children, the descendants of those who were Anusim, who were forced against their will to give up their faith, and for no crime. The similarity is, in the case of the Holocaust, the Jews had committed no crimes. In the case of the Inquisition, the Jews had committed no crimes. In fact, in both cases, they had made contributions both to Germany and to Spain. Why did these things happen? There were two different motivations. Hitler's was to get rid of the Jews, genocide, and the church was to force to get rid of Judaism and have the Jews adopt another religion. That's what it's all about.
You mentioned earlier a DNA test, and a lot of people, quickest way now is to Google anything and go and find out.
Right.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but apparently there is information on the internet that you can find out, depending on your last name, Hispanic last name, Spanish last name, if you do indeed have Jewish roots.
Well, one of the real experts of the of the crypto-Jewish experience in New Mexico, Stan Hortus, who was the state historian of New Mexico, when he began to do additional research on the subject, he believes that the names are not as, let's say, provable indicators that one is definitely has Sephardic background. There are certain distinguishing marks in a name, like let's take a name like Gonzalez. And I'll be honest, I'm not an expert in this field, but I remember him at one of the lectures he gave. There was a commonality among those who were descendants of the crypto Jews or of the Anusim. And they would use an S instead of a Z. And I believe that was one. But according to him, that is not as provable because over the years, people change their names. And so it is an indicator, because there are some very common Jewish names among the Spanish community. But the DNA is a more recognizable indicator of one's Jewish roots, more so than the name. What happened with him was, when he became the state historian, people would start to come to him, not as they did to me with the interest of perhaps returning to Judaism, but they would go to a cemetery in a remote community in New Mexico, and there in a Catholic cemetery, they would see one of their relatives, and on the tombstone there were Hebrew symbols, like a Jewish star or a menorah or even occasionally some Hebrew lettering. And what was that doing in a Catholic cemetery? And then he began, I think that was really what started his interest in the subject.
We have a couple of minutes left, sure. And I want to talk a little bit about the center. And there's going to be a benefit concert, and that's this coming Tuesday. And that is Robin Helsner. Our own Dennis Wu had an interview with Robin, and he'll talk a little bit more about that. But she's going to talk about A Key to the Casa and sing.
Robin Helsner has been a singer for many years, and she has a variety of songs in her repertoire. But one of her specialties is the area of Sephardic Jewish Ladino songs. And she not only tells the story, but she sings the story. And as I said before, the music of that Sephardic Jewish Ladino milieu is fascinating and beautiful and spiritual, and it's a wonderful opportunity. She'll be at, we're doing this together, the Anosim Center and my synagogue congregation, B'nai Zion, 805 Cherry Hill Lane, Tuesday, January 23rd at 7 p.m., $10 for adults, $5 for children, and please try to come.
We didn't get to touch base on this very much, but you have a CD also, and people who are on Facebook, on social media, can see you on there. And this CD is, you mentioned your dad was a cantor, and this is a CD called Songs My Father Taught Me.
Yeah.
Then they can get that through the congregation?
They can get that through the congregation or directly contact me. So my email is rabbisal, R-A-B-B-I-S-A-L at AOL.com, and my cell phone, 915-526-3693.
Well, thank you so much for being with us here today, Rabbi.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been visiting with Rabbi Stephen Leon with the Anosim Center and also Congregation B'nai Zion. We could talk for hours about the history of Judaism and some of the other things that Rabbi Leon was talking about, but you can find out more information about what Rabbi Leon has been talking about. Is there a webpage, Rabbi Leon?
We're developing right now. But it is the Anosim Center of El Paso.
Thank you so much for being with us. The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Luis Sainz.
Support for local production of The Weekend on KTEP comes from the estate of Maxie Templeton.